establishment. And we see many people there who still command militias, who had committed atrocities during the civil war, who led to the death of thousands of people. And they're there sitting in the parliament or appearing on TV every day. Why? Because there is no accountability. Same thing with your country. I mean, people are either dying peacefully or going to paint and reinventing themselves as ski resort trainers and whatnot. This is a disaster. You know, all these lives, Iraqi and American, by the way, are lost, are wasted for nothing. And
Raith, we have to leave it there, but we're going to do part two and post it at democracynow.org. Raith Abdulahad, his new book, A Stranger in Your Own City, Travels in the Middle East Long War. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
This is Bill McKibben coming at you on KBOO Portland, Oregon.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, incidents of hate at a record rate for both Oregon and Washington. Within a week of a train derailment in Washington, a big hearing in the nation's capital about railway safety. And workers may soon have more rights to their personnel files.
So I think it's reasonable to ask employers to find things within 2 weeks.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 23rd, 2023. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us. New information from the Anti-Defamation League, a regional chapter of a national anti-hate group, shows anti-Semitism is on the rise. Incidents of anti-Semitic hate rose sharply in Oregon and the Pacific Northwest in 2022. The group says this may signal problems with white supremacy as a whole. White supremacist ideologies often include conspiracy theories involving Jewish people. Hatred for Black people, immigrants, and the LGBTQ plus community are also often fostered in these same ideologies. Experts say understanding the roots of these racist belief systems is key to fighting them. The ADL has conducted an annual audit of acts of harassment and intimidation against Jewish people since 1979. It compiles and reviews information from victims, law enforcement, and community leaders. The ADL recorded 40 anti-Semitic hate incidents in Oregon in its 2022 audit, the most ever, and 65 incidents in Washington, which was also a record. Incidents were up 36% nationally. Actions reported in the Pacific Northwest included the distribution of anti-Semitic flyers, a bomb threat at a Jewish school in Seattle, and a racist attack on a Portland library security guard who was Jewish. There have already been at least three 2023 incidents of anti-Semitic flyers being put out in Oregon, all in Lane County. There's also been immediate pushback. Flyers urging people to love your neighbors were also distributed in Lane County this winter, shortly after anti-Semitic flyers were left out. Volunteers also conducted door-knocking campaigns led by the Community Alliance of Lane County, a Showing Up for Racial Justice chapter, and two Eugene-based neighborhood associations. One important goal was to let people in the community know how to report extremism. People who spread messages of hate appear to be hoping for media attention that will amplify their rhetoric. The message of community unity may counter that. People observing hate incidents can call Oregon's Bias Response Hotline at 1-844-924-BIAS, or they can file an incident report online at standagainsthate.oregon.gov. The ADL said, quote, "As much as these are grim statistics, we're also inspired by how many people are speaking up and the kind of leadership that Oregon and the Attorney General and other leaders are showing, and we really hope that it's a model for the nation," end quote. Washington state workers may soon get more access to important employment information. State lawmakers are considering a measure that ensures workers have access to their personnel files. Businesses would have to pay up to $1,000 fines if they delay releasing their employees' personnel files longer than 4 weeks. Eric Tegedoff has the story.
A person's work personnel file can be important to review, but some Washingtonians are finding them hard to obtain. A bill in Olympia would ensure they get them in a timely manner. The legislation would require businesses to release workers' personnel files within 14 days or pay statutory damages to the worker. These files can contain key information on an employee's termination, for workers' compensation cases, or unemployment benefits. Democratic Representative Julia Reed of Seattle says some companies withhold files for long periods of time or hand them over heavily redacted.
If you're trying to get unemployment, you don't have a month to wait for your employer to say that they found your file. So I think it's reasonable to ask employers to find things within 2 weeks.
Opponents of the bill say it will be hard for businesses to accommodate these requests in the bill's 14-day time period, especially for small businesses. The legislation has passed the House and is scheduled for executive session in the Senate Committee on Labor and Commerce today. Jesse Wing is a trial lawyer in Seattle and says this bill puts teeth in the current law when it comes to handing over personnel files. He is critical of businesses opposed to the measure.
It all seems like an effort to shut down kind of a due process of an employee to know what's going on with their employment, and I think that just emphasizes the need for this bill.
Reed says the goal of this bill is to help workers.
This bill just basically tries to balance the scales a little bit and say that this information that your employer keeps on you is your information and you should have a right to see it.
I'm Eric Tegedoff.
On the heels of the Norfolk Southern February 3rd hazardous train derailment in Ohio and another BNSF derailment in Washington State last week, Washington U.S. Senator Maria Cantwell opened a hearing on Capitol Hill about railway safety. Here's part of what the chair of the Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation said.
While the information age gives us all sorts of ideas about efficiency, we can't take that to the extreme when you end up cutting safety. And the safety standards, we have to have minimum safety standards, we have to have modernization of safety technology, and we have to have the minimum amount of people to do the job. So that's what's going to be required across every sector of transportation. And this committee is going to make sure that we get there, because we can't, because we're not going to let people just keep, you know, putting money in the bank and thinking that you can shortchange safety. And we can't shortchange East Palestine. We have to look at safety trends. We have to look at what's coming at us, because they are telling us in advance. That's what technology can do. Tell us in advance where there's a problem. But we can't ignore that because we want to make some more money.
That's Washington U.S. Senator Maria Cantwell. The Senate committee heard testimony and questioned witnesses, including Norfolk Southern CEO Alan Shaw and NTSB Chair Jennifer Homendy. The derailment near Padilla Bay in Washington State spilled more than 5,000 gallons of diesel fuel in what Cantwell calls a very sensitive aquatic ecosystem. Important decisions are also underway right now when it comes to the future of healthcare in our community and our country. Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden addressed some of his concerns about the latest budget.
The president's budget comes down to a simple proposition: helping working families and the middle class get ahead and reducing the federal deficit are not mutually exclusive. We're committed to doing both. When it comes to healthcare, that means protecting Medicare, for the next generation by making sure that the wealthy pay their fair share in taxes, strengthening Medicare's negotiating power for the cost of prescription medicine, and investing in priorities like mental health care, home-based care, and the health care workforce. That's a sharp contrast to the Republican approach to the federal budget. Since the beginning of the year, there's basically been a demand for secret negotiations on unspecified cuts to federal programs while holding hostage the full faith and credit of the United States government. Budget Committee Chair Whitehouse and I asked the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office to run the numbers, and it's clear that Republican promises to spare certain parts of the budget, like Social Security, simply don't add up. Sparing essential lifelines for seniors, in addition to Republican priorities, means essentially zeroing out everything else in the federal budget. I would like to take a moment to address press reports that some House members are considering proposals that cut earned benefits in Medicare or Social Security for those who are not yet at retirement age. I want to be clear. As long as I'm chair of this committee, I will fight any effort to engage in intergenerational warfare. There are plenty of ideas to improve the financial health of these programs that do not include forfeiting the earned benefits of current workers. Now, I'm going to take a minute to talk about what that means in practical terms, starting with Medicaid. Contrary to popular belief, Medicaid acts as our country's backstop for nursing home care, not Medicare. And since my days as director of the Great Panthers, I've been stunned at how many people still believe Medicare leads in the effort to fund nursing home care. That's just not accurate. It's Medicaid. That means when your parents are in their 80s or 90s and require nursing home care, Medicaid is there to help cover the cost once they have essentially gone through all the hard-earned retirement savings and everything they did to try to plan for retirement while they were working. If Republicans go after Medicaid the way they did in 2017 by cutting federal support to state Medicaid programs and giving states free rein to pare back benefits, that guaranteed backstop of nursing home care for seniors is ripped away. That means a return to times from distant memory before the social safety net was created, when older Americans who ran out of savings and couldn't count on a family member were essentially consigned to a poor farm. Nobody wants America to return to that way. So let's look for ways to work together to take on the big challenges of our time, rather than pursuing reckless cuts that imperil the country's older people. Now, a couple of important priorities in the president's budget. First, on prescription drugs. The president's budget has several bold proposals to build on the Inflation Reduction Act that holds pharma accountable for years of high prices while lowering costs for seniors. That includes speeding up Medicare negotiations and increasing the number of drugs subject to negotiation. I strongly support this approach, especially as the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services continues to steadily implement the laws that are already on the books. For example, last week, the Biden administration announced that the anti-price gouging law that was written in this committee, in this room, on a bipartisan basis in 2019 will lower coinsurance payments for 27 drugs in Medicare Part B. Part B pays for prescription drugs to treat diseases like cancer and rheumatoid arthritis administered in a physician's office. That includes Humira. And folks, Humira is Exhibit A for why drug pricing reforms were needed in the first place. Important steps like these coinsurance reductions, free vaccines, and the insulin cost cap in Medicare are just the beginning of the big league impact this law will have on Americans' health care costs. And I want to make clear, I've said from the beginning that when the federal government leads on flagship health reforms and Medicare and in its key programs, we know as sure as the night follows the day that the private sector is going to follow, and that is exactly what's happened. Next, mental health care. Very fitting, since my seatmate here has been the leader here in the Senate of that cause, Senator Stabenow. Last Congress, the committee wrote black letter law to move the country towards a reality where all Americans can get quality mental health care when and where they need it. I especially want to thank my partner here on the Finance Committee, Senator Crapo. At the beginning of 2021, we said on mental health care, we are going to be ready on every single bill, every single one to make sure that we advance the cause of mental health needs. And we were able to do that on the gun safety law with improved mental health care in schools, funding for community behavioral health centers, led, as I mentioned, by Senator Stabenow, coverage for therapists and Medicare, new GME slots for psychiatrists. And Senator Crapo and I talk often about this, and we intend to continue our mental health work in this Congress, again, in a bipartisan way. When it comes to mental health parity, the Congress passed a landmark law in 2008 based on the proposition that physical and mental health would be treated equally. That, unfortunately, doesn't happen today. 15 years after the law was written, the insurance companies, the big insurance companies, are still finding ways to drag their feet on carrying out the parity law with respect to mental health. So the challenge for the committee is to stop the foot dragging that is taking place under current law, colleagues. The 2008 law and develop fresh approaches to give Americans what they thought they were getting in 2008. The president's budget takes important steps in that direction, and I'm pleased that Senator Bennett also is leading the way to put mental health care on a better footing. We're also pleased that the president's budget takes a big step when it comes to postpartum coverage for new mothers in Medicaid.
That's Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden speaking in the nation's capital. A new report charts a course for meeting the challenges of bigger and more destructive wildfires across the western United States. Eric Galatas reports the report is called Roadmap for Wildfire Resilience, Solutions for a Paradigm Shift, and it's by the Aspen Institute and the Nature Conservancy.
As wildfire seasons across the American West become longer, less predictable, and increasingly destructive, a new report aims to provide an equitable roadmap for protecting communities, watersheds, and wildlife. Rob Addington with the Nature Conservancy in Colorado says engagement with tribal nations who have been successful stewards of lands for thousands of years will be critical to address the scale of the challenge.
Developing tribal partnerships and really looking to tribal knowledge, ecological knowledge that many of the tribes hold from their centuries in many cases of working with the land, working with fire.
Addington says the roadmap represents a paradigm shift in modern forest and wildfire management. After decades of fire prevention strategies, for example, experts say controlled burns will be necessary to thin fuel supplies across thousands of acres of dry western lands. The report also calls for advanced computer modeling and unmanned drones to improve early detection, help battle fires more effectively, and to reseed and restore scarred forests. The roadmap, created by the Aspen Institute and the Nature Conservancy, compiles input from over 250 experts in forest and fire management, federal, state, local, and tribal nation authorities, and the private sector, including the forest products and insurance industries. Addington says much of the report's recommendations are shovel-ready due to recent public investments, such as the Bipartisan Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and Inflation Reduction Act.
But what we need in parallel to kind of complement that funding is this set of policy recommendations to really make best use of that funding and have it hit the ground in the most efficient and effective way that we can.
Addington underscores that building successful partnerships will be key for work that needs to happen in metropolitan areas and across tribal, federal, state, and privately owned lands. The report also identifies some potential roadblocks and offers policy solutions requiring action from Congress, the executive branch, and partners like states, tribal nations, nonprofits, and industry.
This is Eric Galatas reporting.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, the Indigenous Power Hour. Tonight's weather, showers this evening, becoming steady light rain overnight, down to 38 for the low. Tomorrow's weather, rain showers in the morning, up to a high of 45 and steady rain in the afternoon, changing to mixed rain and snow later at night. Today in history, German mathematician Emmy Noether was born on this date in 1883. Her innovations in higher algebra made her one of the most creative and respected abstract mathematicians of modern times. The quote of the day is from Emmy Noether. I think it is a duty I owe to my profession and to my sex to show that a woman has a right to the practice of her profession and cannot be condemned to abandon it merely because she marries. The Fed raises interest rates and reassures that the banking system is sound. Norfolk Southern reaffirms a commitment to the people of East Palestine, Ohio, and TikTok creators gather at the Capitol to support free expression. For more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's 2023 Talks.
Our banking system is sound and resilient with strong capital and liquidity. We will continue to closely monitor conditions in the banking system and are prepared to use all of our tools as needed to keep it safe and sound.
Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell sought to reassure consumers after the failures of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank, the nation's second and third largest bank failures on record. Powell also announced another quarter point interest rate hike, even as some financial experts claim high interest rates contributed to the bank failures. Norfolk Southern CEO Alan Shaw testified before the Senate Commerce Committee Wednesday following the recent derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, which spilled chemicals in the air, water, and soil. Shaw reaffirmed his company's committed to continue cleanup efforts and help area residents.
I'm able to share more about our plans. We're in the planning stages of developing a long-term medical compensation fund, a property value assurance program, and a longer-term water testing program.
At a Senate committee meeting, Moderna CEO Stefan Bancel defended the company's decision to significantly increase the price of its COVID shots to $130 when they start to be sold on the private market this fall. Moderna had been charging the U.S. government $26 per dose. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders pressed the CEO.
Quadrupling the price is huge, and I would hope very much that you will reconsider that decision. It's going to cost the taxpayers of this country billions of dollars.
Kentucky Senator Rand Paul got into a heated exchange with the CEO over COVID-19 vaccine side effects relating to myocarditis, which is inflammation of the heart muscle.
We spoke with your president just last week, and he readily acknowledged in private that, yes, there is an increased risk of myocarditis. The fact that you can't say it in public is quite disturbing.
Bancel refused to acknowledge the study cited by Paul, but did respond, saying scientific data shows those who take vaccines are less likely to develop myocarditis versus those who contract COVID-19. New York Representative Jamal Bowman and creators of the popular social media app TikTok held a news conference at the Capitol in support of free expression, as President Biden and congressional leaders increasingly called the Chinese-owned app a national security threat. Tiffany Yu is a disability advocate and TikTok creator.
TikTok has really been a game changer for me. It's allowed me to reach new audiences, millions of people, unlock new ways to generate income to support my advocacy, and empower an entire group of disability advocates to find their voice and build their careers.
Lawmakers continue to push for a nationwide ban of the app or force TikTok's owners to sell. I'm Alex Gonzalez.
Troubling trends such as an increasing maternal mortality rate are plaguing pregnant women in Idaho. But as Eric Tegadar reports, lawmakers could end their current session failing to address their health concerns.
The maternal mortality rate doubled each year between 2019 and 2021 in Idaho. The state also ranks last for income eligibility for pregnant women on Medicaid. House Bill 201 would have extended Medicaid coverage from 60 days to 12 months after birth, but has not received a hearing. Hillary Hagen with Idaho Voices for Children says a large coalition of healthcare organizations, providers, and families supported the legislation.
Providing access to affordable health coverage helps reduce maternal mortality rates, improves birth outcomes, and Idaho's maternal health trends are going to continue on their downward trajectory every year we don't take action.
Nampa Republican and House Health and Welfare Committee Chairman John Vanderwoude said he was supportive of the bill and that he'd received a number of calls in support of it. However, Vanderwoude said the committee won't hold a hearing on it this session because the legislature has to get control of the Medicaid budget first. This week, Bonner General Hospital at Sandpoint announced it would no longer deliver babies because of a provider shortage. The hospital also cited Idaho's legal and political climate as part of the reason for closing its maternity ward. Hagen says the provider shortage has become exacerbated in recent years.
We're increasingly seeing providers choose to leave the state because of policy decisions made by Idaho lawmakers. It's really discouraging to see that we are reducing access for moms and their babies.
Another measure unlikely to pass this session is House Bill 81, which would have extended the federally funded Maternal Mortality Review Committee past its sunset date in July. Hagen says after that, Idaho will be the only state in the nation without a Maternal Mortality Review Committee.
A bus ran into a car in what a Guatemalan indigenous environmental activist says was an attempt on his life this week. With that story and more, here's Jill Freitas with the National Native News.
A bill in the Washington legislature seeks to make it easier for people who commit crimes on Native American reservations to face justice. Steve Jackson reports.
The bill had a hearing in the Senate Law and Justice Committee this week.
Swinomish Tribal Prosecutor Melissa Simonson says in many cases, it can be very difficult to get those charged with a crime committed on a reservation back to face trial if they flee.
In the judicial system, if a tribal court issues a warrant for serious crimes, assaults against children, domestic violence, sexual assault, stalking, and that individual leaves the reservation, there is no access to justice. The warrant cannot be collected upon by any Washington state law enforcement officer.
This measure would allow a tribal prosecutor to go to the state attorney general's office or the local prosecutor's office to seek a warrant. Some who testified spoke of current agreements between tribes and individual counties to bring people to justice. Russell Brown of the Washington Association of Prosecuting Attorneys expressed some concerns with the way the bill is currently written. He said that there might be a better way to achieve the goal with less complexity.
Each tribe within Washington could enter into an agreement with the governor of Washington. There wouldn't need to be simple agreements between all the counties. For example, you wouldn't need 39 counties agreeing with 29 tribes. You would have one state compact that the tribes could agree and enter into.
The bill originally passed the House on March the 1st. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
A Guatemalan indigenous environmental activist says there was an attempt on his life this week as a bus ran into the cart in which he was driving on a highway in northern Guatemala. As Maria Martin reports, Bernardo Caal Shull has been criminalized for many years as a result of his work trying to save a Guatemalan river.
51-year-old Bernardo Caal Shull is a Maya Kekchi teacher, union activist, and environmental leader in the northern Guatemalan province of Alta Verapaz. He was released from prison last year after serving 4 years on charges Amnesty International says are spurious and retaliatory. The human rights organization has declared Cal a, quote, prisoner of conscience, saying he's been criminalized for his work opposing a hydroelectric project on the Cajabon River, which the Kekchi Maya consider sacred. On Monday, Cal reported on a Facebook video that his car had been deliberately hit from behind after he'd left court for a mandatory appearance in the city of Coban. Gal complained of back and chest pain, standing alongside his almost totally destroyed vehicle. He says he fears for his life and is asking Guatemalan authorities to investigate the incident. But some analysts doubt that Bernardo Caal Shull will get justice from the same system that's worked to criminalize him and other Guatemalan indigenous activists for years. For National Native News, I'm Maria Martin.
Former president of the Navajo Nation, Ben Shelley, passed away from a long-term illness on Wednesday at the age of 75. Shelley served as a member of the Navajo Nation Council for more than a decade, beginning in the early 1990s. Before being elected as vice president in 2007. He went on to becoming president of the tribe through 2015. He also served as a county commissioner. Shelley is being remembered for his longtime leadership and is credited for establishing the Navajo Transitional Energy Company, which was created to achieve greater sovereignty over the tribe's natural resources. I'm Jill Freitas.
The demand is growing for native seeds across the West, but the supply just isn't there. As Alex Gonzalez reports, this impacts more than 615 million acres in the western part of our country as extreme weather events affect native plant communities.
Researchers with the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine say in the West, extreme weather events driven by climate change are a big threat to native plant communities. One of the authors of the report is Kayrie Havens with the Chicago Botanic Garden. She calls native seed supply critical for restoration efforts. Havens says with the current insufficient supply, restoration efforts could be faced with the tough decisions to substitute with non-native species, utilize native species from climatically different environments, or not do anything at all.
You really need locally adapted seed to have it succeed over the long term in restoration. And I think many of the restoration failures that we've seen over the last 20-30 years are in part due to not having the correct seed to use.
Havens calls native seed one of the most undervalued natural resources. She says plant communities provide what she calls ecosystem services, such as helping prevent floods and helping purify the air. Aspects, she says, are essential for the success of everyone. The scientists behind the report spent 2 years studying the nation's supply of native seed and found significant deficiencies when it came to the nation's pipeline of viable native seed. The report calls for coordinated leadership between the U.S. Department of the Interior, Agriculture, and Defense, while also supporting regional partnerships. Vera Smith with Defenders of Wildlife says it'll lead to better insight to know what seed is needed.
Our insufficient supply is a major barrier to ecological restoration and other revegetation projects that we need to do across the nation in order to keep keep our lands healthy, natural, and resilient.
I'm Alex Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, March 23rd, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Eric Tegadoff, Eric Alatis, and Alex Gonzalez. The producers Annette Newell and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. Our director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
It's now no secret that the Multnomah County Animal Shelter, known as MCAS in Troutdale, has some serious issues. Multiple reports in local media recently have revealed a shelter that for years has been chronically short-staffed, has a lack of trust between employees, volunteers, and staff, and most troubling, gives very poor and inconsistent animal care. These issues have been known to our county leaders since 2016 and 2018, when two audits were completed showing the extent of the problems. And yet, the county commission took little action to address those problems. Volunteers and local rescues who complained regularly about the shelter feared that nothing would ever change. MCAS closed to the public during the pandemic, and last December became so overcrowded it closed to any new intakes of animals. The new Multnomah County chair made the shelter reopen and launched a five-month review of shelter operations. Tonight, I'm speaking with Kelly and Amanda, two longtime MCAS volunteers who have been tirelessly advocating for the animals at the shelter for years, and they have asked that their last names not be used in this broadcast. Later, I will talk to Aaron Grayheck, the current director of Multnomah County Animal Services, who has been in the position since